This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Thank you all for coming today. Welcome you to our Animal Law Week presentation for today, Advocating for Animals. I want to thank our panelists for being here. We have Pamela Alexander, of the Animal Legal Defense Fund, Jordan Matches of the Humane Society, and Delcy Winders, of associate at Meyer, Glistenstein, and Frisco. And I also want to thank the McCormick Companion Animal Fund for making all of this possible. And we can go ahead and start the presentation.
Thank you. I'm Pam Alexander, and as Aubrey mentioned, I'm the director of the Animal Law Program at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, and it's a pleasure for me to be here and see so much interest in animal law and animal protection issues. I was actually here a couple years ago meeting with a dean to talk about animal law, and it's so rewarding to see that you've started a chapter here, a student Animal Legal Defense Fund chapter, and I hear courses potentially in the works, as well as this wonderful Animal Law Week. It's very encouraging. And by the way, the Student Animal Legal Defense Fund chapter that was just formed this semester rounds out the top 10 law schools in the country, so now there's a Student Animal Legal Defense Fund chapter at the top 10 law schools. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Animal Legal Defense Fund, we've been around for about 30 years, and our mission is to protect the lives and advance the interests of animals through the legal system. And we have three main programs. We have our criminal justice program. That works directly with DAs across the country, as well as law enforcement officials, to help them and assist them prosecute animal cruelty cases throughout the country. We also have our civil litigation department, which works on high impact cases, 30,000 feet up, to see what can we do within the legal system to really have the largest impact on the largest number of animals. And then we have our animal law program, which is what I oversee, which works to foster and facilitate the development of animal law in law schools, as well as within legal practice. And when Vince invited me to sit on the panel today, he had asked that we talk a little bit about our path and how we ended up where we are, and I'm happy to share that information with you, and hopefully it's not too boring. When I was in law school, there weren't any chapters or classes, but I knew that I wanted to use my law degree to work for animal rights or animal protection. And this stemmed from a couple years prior to starting law school. I was living in New York City at the time, and I had adopted my dog, Max, the ASPCA there, and he came from a very abusive situation. And I couldn't really understand how anyone could victimize these helpless animals. A couple years later, I adopted another dog. Her name is Sophie. Same situation, came from this horrible, abusive situation. And when I got to law school, I started to focus on the link between domestic violence and animal cruelty. And it turns out I met someone who had a similar interest in law schools and, in animal protection. And rather than studying, we would sit in the atrium and talk about what we wanted to do for animals. And what we decided we wanted to do is we started a non-for-profit when we were in law school called Sheltering Animals of Abuse Victims, or the SAFE program. And what this program does is it provides confidential temporary shelter for companion animals of victims of domestic violence. I'm sure most of you in the room know that so oftentimes the animal will be retaliated against, killed, or severely hurt if someone tries to leave an abusive situation. So we determined that by being able to remove that final roadblock, or one of the roadblocks to get out of the house, more and more people would get into safe shelter. What maybe applies to you all is we were able to convince a professor to allow us to start this nonprofit for credit. And so what started out as a little two-credit project is still a thriving nonprofit in Madison, Wisconsin, and we're able to plug people into safe shelters as well as their companion animals with the ultimate goal of reuniting them in a safer setting. After I graduated from law school, I was hooked. I knew I wanted to do this with my profession. However, there just aren't as many job opportunities as we would all hope. I went into private practice. I started to teach the first animal law course at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I remained involved in SAVE, and then I also started to volunteer for the Animal Legal Defense Fund. So anytime they had a case in Wisconsin or needed assistance, I would jump right in and continue to network with the group that way. About a couple years after I graduated, there was a job opening at ALDF for a staff attorney in the animal law program, which I applied for, and I thankfully got it, and then a year later I was promoted to director. So I can truly say that I do have my dream job. I feel very, very fortunate because I'm in the position where I can marry my passion with my profession. And so what I did for today's presentation, as director of the Animal Law Program, probably the most frequent question I get asked on a daily basis is, how can I get involved in animal law? We have over 130 student Animal Legal Defense Fund chapters right now. There's over 100 classes at law schools across the country, and I oversee programs for our 600 volunteer attorney members. But this is the reoccurring theme. You know, 5 years ago it was, oh, there's no classes, there's no chapters, there's nothing we can do in law school. Well, we've come a long way, but now it's, there's not enough jobs. So what we like to do is counsel people on ways that they can incorporate animal law into their practice, as well as how they can get involved in volunteer opportunities. And just by way of background, this is the definition of animal law that I like to work with. As most of you know, animal law permeates the traditional areas of the law: contracts, torts, criminal law, family law, constitutional law. So that really provides an opportunity for incorporating animal law into practice. And what I'm going to share with you right now is some of the ways that our attorney members have incorporated animal law into their profession. The first one is estate planning. I'm sure all of us in the room, or most of us in this room, were surprised when we learned that Leona Hemsley left $12 million to her dog Trouble. We all had that, oh my gosh, reaction. And that's a very magnified view of this area of the law, but more and more clients want to make sure that their companion animals are taken care of after their passing. And currently there are 38 states in the District of Columbia that allow for companion animal trust. So that's one way we're seeing more and more of our attorney members getting involved in animal law. Same with custody disputes, and this is gaining ground, and we hear about this all the time. It's in the media quite a bit, and statistics are showing that divorcing couples more and more are willing to spend time and resources to fight over custody of the companion animal. And one tool that I like to always highlight, which I think is very extreme but it's indicative of this trend, is something called contest calling. Has anyone heard of that? You have? Okay. What it is essentially is you're in a neutral location with a divorcing couple, the husband's over here, the wife's over here, a neutral person brings in the dog, and they frantically start to call for the dog to come over to them. Whoever the dog goes to, it's decided they're awarded custody. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense, it's flawed in a lot of reasons, but it does show you the amount of time and resources and money people are willing to put into these custody disputes. Vet malpractice cases is gaining momentum as far as a practice area for a lot of our attorney members. According to the American Veterinary Medical Association, 64 million companion owners in the U.S. now spend more than $18 billion a year on animal health care. And as a guardian of a typical American dog, you will spend more than $11,500 on this dog's care during his or her lifetime, and that may not be surprising to you all in the room. And although the vet malpractice cases were not seeing as large a judgments as we do against doctors who treat humans, it really is gaining ground, and more judgments are being made in favor of the companion animal guardians. This is an interesting area that people, some attorneys are able to have a stable income with these free speech cases, the First Amendment free speech cases for animal activists who have been denied the right to protest or leaflet, present another avenue for practitioners to get along, to get involved, because they have fee provisions. So again, it can provide a stable income for animal law practitioners. And finally, I just wanted to mention teaching an animal law course. Currently, most of these animal law courses are being taught by adjunct professors. There's approximately 200 ABA-accredited law schools, and there's about 100 animal law classes being taught at these law schools. And of course, our goal is to have a course at every single law school. So it does present a unique opportunity after you graduate to get involved with your local law school and start to teach a course. Now, for some of you, you won't be going into your own practice. You may not have the opportunity to incorporate some of those ideas. And by the way, that list was not meant to be exhaustive. It's just some ideas of ways you can get involved. And the overarching message is, I think you have to be creative and flexible with this rapidly emerging field and find what your passion is and pursue it from that angle. A lot of ways that attorneys get involved in animal currently is through volunteer opportunities, and I'll mention the Animal Law Program. As I said, we have 600 plus volunteer attorney members, and they do everything from research and writing to filing briefs for us, even litigating cases. It's primarily within our two divisions, which is the Criminal Justice Program, which would be assisting ADAs and DAs across the country, or in our Civil Litigation Department, where we've been recently focusing on a lot on farmed animal issues, because currently there's an estimated 10 billion animals who are raised and killed for food every year in the U.S. So we've chosen this as a focus of different ways we can get creative with filing these civil litigation lawsuits. Most of the larger national organizations all have litigation departments or some sort of need. I've listed a few up there. I'm sorry, I don't have Farm Sanctuary up there. I'll be sure to add that. But I encourage you, if you don't want to volunteer for ALDF, to contact anyone that you have an interest in. And same thing for your local animal protection groups or humane societies. Locally, once you graduate, you go to a community, your law degree is pure gold to these people. You can sit on their board, you can draft adoption contracts. There's just unlimited ways for you to use your law degree. We also assist people who are interested in starting bar sections or committees. There's about 20 in the country right now. We do have a how-to guide if you're interested in that. If there's one in your area, I would encourage you to join it. If there's not, I would encourage you to form your own section of the bar. Sometimes this is denied by the bar, so we see groups go ahead and start their own independent groups. That's happened in Florida and Georgia and Michigan, where they're just as active, but they're independent of the bar section. And then I always like to encourage people to write articles. We all know the legal system takes forever. We all know sometimes we don't get the results we want. But we still have a forum and opinion pieces and local newspapers and national newspapers and magazine articles. Start to submit and write and do press releases, and you'd be surprised that a lot of your work would get picked up. And again, I mentioned student mentorship. Once you graduate, you'll all be more than likely by a law school. I would encourage you to be a speaker, volunteer time, teach a class, go ahead and spend some time with the chapters, have them come into your practice, be a mentor, because the field needs more and more attorneys. As far as this slide goes, I put this up, pro bono work at a firm. Things have changed so much in the last couple years. There was a time that we would call the medium to large law firms and just beg them for assistance. Please help us. You know, we're a little nonprofit, and they have all these resources at their disposal. And if we were lucky, we would get a heavy hitter who was willing to assist us, whether it's criminal justice or civil litigation. And the tide has turned, and we are working with the top law firms in the country who actually call us now saying, we want to allocate our animal law pro bono hours to animal rights and protection. And so much has to do because of you. You know, these associates, they are graduating with their experience in animal law at their law schools, and they're demanding that they get to do their hours on animal law pro bono work. So I would encourage you, if you're going to a larger law firm and you're interested in animal law, just to do a few things. You can let them know of your interest early on. You can contact me and you can ask me if that law firm is doing animal law pro bono work. Again, a lot of them already are. Provide information about animal law. There's a beautiful case book that's used in about 95% of the animal law courses. It really legitimizes it. Let them know the other law firms, the types of cases. Some of the law firms I work with, they don't feel comfortable diving into factory farm cases right away, or you know, medical research or entertainment. They want to start with companion animals, and that's great. You can start with companion animals, expose people to the plight of animals, and you can grow from there. Some right away say, we feel passionate about farmed animal issues, and that's what we want to work on. And I can't tell you, you're exposing a whole new group of people to animal rights as associates. You go in, you need a partner to review your work, all of a sudden they're hooked in getting the law firms involved and the rest of the partners. So I think it's another avenue for advocating. Provide information about potential projects, whether you're working with ALDF or any of the other national organizations. They'll be able to give you a range of the types of things that you are working on. I always encourage people to reference the other law firms that are working on animal law projects. I think it's good from a competitive standpoint. And again, I'm more than happy to help you with that. But I am just so impressed with the people who are working with us on our campaigns. And because it's such a rapidly emerging field, it's so exciting and there's so much work to be done. You know, society's views of animals up here, the legal system's here, and there's all this gray area. It's a unique opportunity in history right now to set new case law, set new precedent, and I think that's a good selling point that you can tell your animal law, the pro bono committee, that you get to work on something that's very, very cutting edge. And I always like to throw this slide up here. And one of my favorite quotes is from over a century ago from a philosopher. His name is John Stuart Mill. And he concluded that every great movement goes through three phases: ridicule, discussion, and adoption. And when I first stumbled upon this quote about 5 years ago, I remember saying, well, you know, we're somewhere between ridicule and discussion, and hopefully in my lifetime it will be adoption, and things are changing so fast, I feel like I have to say, well, now we're in between discussion and adoption, and with all these students and chapters and animal law courses, I'm really encouraged and hopeful that we will see adoption in the very near future. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to contact me. That's my email information. That's our website. If you're interested in learning more about student opportunities, I'll just wrap by saying that we do provide project grants for our Student Animal Legal Defense Fund chapters, unlimited grants. We also have scholarship opportunities, merit-based, as well as paid clerkship opportunities if you're interested in doing a clerkship while you're still a law student. So please go ahead and contact me, and I'll leave some cards, too. Thank you.
Give me one second. Society of the United States. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you to Vince, and thanks for everyone for listening. I'm going to go at this from a different angle. I'm going to talk about my background, what we're pushing in Illinois. So the Humane Society of the United States is located in Washington, D.C. We have about 500, 600 people there, and then we're located in about 38 states. There's a state director. So I'm responsible for all of Illinois. And then finally, we'll talk about what you can do. So a little bit about my history, how I ended up here. I'm mostly a political hack. I love politics. I worked for somebody running for Congress. I've worked for some think tanks. I worked for Al Gore. I worked in the White House for 2 years. And then most recently, what's helped me is I worked for the governor for the Department of Financial and Professional Regulations for 2 years, and I worked for the Speaker of the House. If any of you have a chance to work for the legislative body, it is an amazing experience. It's an interesting way to use your law degree. I'm sure you're all looking through some laws right now and thinking, who the hell drafted this crap? Well, it's usually someone like me who's drunk at 2 in the morning. So that's why there's typos and stuff. Litigation. Well, there's tons and tons of other ways to use your law degree. I did work for a judge, and I worked for the city, and then just last year, I was working for a law firm doing toxic tort defense, represent petrochemical companies that were polluting. So I'm very happy to work with the Humane Society right now. I'm also a member of what's called the Canine Therapy Corps. I'll be leaving in a couple of hours to go. My dog works every Wednesday night at the Rehab Institute of Chicago, which is part of Northwestern, and she's a therapy dog. Another great thing that I do that she was just talking about is I am a foster parent, but I'm also the counsel for the Chicago English Bulldog Rescue Group. So I do the adoption contracts. We had somebody bite a dog walker, so I had to get involved with that. So you don't have to get involved with giant litigation. Find a shelter, find a rescue group, and help them. They need help. I also work with Guardian Angel Bassett Rescue, and I think I'm now kind of their counsel since they call me every day. So last night, before we get into everything else, I've got to talk about last night. Of course, Obama won, which is going to be very good for us. A lot better than Sarah Palin. We had a terrific night in Massachusetts. They approved a ban on dog racing. For any of you that don't know, it's a horrible sport in how they treat the animals, and then they just dump them. We've tried this, I think this is our fourth year, and it finally passed last night, so it's very exciting. And our biggest victory was Prop 2 in California. We spent about $8 million with Farm Sanctuary and a whole bunch of other groups. This is really going to revolutionize how we deal with farm animals. It doesn't take place till 2015, but you're going to see changes immediately. We may end up starting to do some of that in Illinois. Illinois is a big pork-producing and egg-producing state, so it's tough in the Midwest. But that doesn't mean we can't take it on. So last night was a very exciting night. And for people who say it takes time, yes, it takes time to do stuff through legislation, through lobbying, but the payoffs are huge. So the HSUS mission is we celebrate animals and we confront cruelty. That's Bertha, my bulldog, who's the therapy dog. We're the world's largest animal welfare organization. We have 10 million members. In Illinois alone, I have 430,000 supporters. Well, that's a nice number. Who cares? What that means to me is when I'm pushing legislation, which is about half of my job, I send out email alerts. I call people, and they call their representatives. Because animals, you know, we have to be the lobbyists. They have no voice. We are their voice. So we've got to be out there pounding the ground, and that's what you can do right now. That's what you can do, you know, immediately. So we have a couple vehicles, what we call for change. We do a lot of legislative work. So I take care of everything in Illinois, Chicago, local villages, municipalities. We have an entire federal team. We have a litigation team. I think we have about 20 attorneys. We spend a lot of time on education, going to high schools, going to colleges, joining law schools. We do a lot of field work. We work with a lot of shelters because the shelters are the day-to-day activity. And not only for dogs and cats, rescue, I just did a raid of a lemur. Now I need to figure out where to put this lemur. So you have to work with all different types of rescue groups. And then we operate a animal sanctuary, a rehab center, and a horse sanctuary. As you may know, these are currently our major efforts, animal fighting and our cruelty campaign. I probably spend 20-30% of my job on cruelty cases. I won't gross you out with too many of them, but you know, dogs, Rottweilers getting their tails hacked off with a hacksaw, people killing puppies with too much marijuana smoke. Anything you can imagine, people are sick enough to do. We spend a lot of time on factory farming. That'll become a bigger issue. We'll talk more about fur. The hunting campaign, we're not doing anything in Illinois this year, but it's always on our mind. We're always looking for people that are hunting and trapping illegally. And then we have a number of other smaller campaigns. So the animal cruelty and fighting campaign, we have a huge campaign in Chicago. We offer a $5,000 reward leading to any tip for dog fighting. We also offer a reward if you have an analogy of somebody abusing a dog. Factory farming is becoming a bigger and bigger campaign. McDonald's is here in Illinois. We will eventually tackle them in the European Union. 100% of their eggs come from cage-free eggs. In the U.S., 100% come from factory farms. So that'll be a big focus soon. Our fur-free campaign we'll talk about in a minute. But if you ever want to go to this website, maybe not so much for the men, but for the women, I guess men wear fur sometimes. We have a list of all the fashion designers that are fur-free and don't use any fur. So even like places like The Gap, if you want to look up a retail store, we'll tell you if they're fur-free or not. This is our hunting campaign. Then we have some smaller campaigns. Currently, probably our biggest one is our Stop Puppy Mill campaign. It's taking up so much of our effort, and we'll talk more about that. Our chimp campaign, both in terms of, I may be introducing something now in the city of Chicago to ban the ownership of pets as primates, but also in terms of scientific research. And then we have our seal hunting campaign. This is our Animal Protection League. If you ever want to go on there, you can see our current litigation docket, our victories. And then you can go ahead and click on any of these. It'll tell you where the cases are pending. So now that you have some information, let's get going and figure out how to use you. I think the first important thing is you have to figure out What are you good at? What do you want to do? You guys generally will probably end up at law firms or working for some law agency. If you want to be a litigator and do that and provide that as your talent, great. If you prefer to write something or to be a graphic designer or just work at a shelter, do that too. But figure out what you want to do. Just because you're a lawyer doesn't mean you have to do law stuff. It helps. It's a great talent. But if you want to get out of the office and into shelter, go work at a shelter. The other important thing is to figure out what your passion is. Do you care about factory farms, cats and dogs? Do you care about furs? We have a huge circus issue going on right now in the city of Chicago. Does Barnum & Bailey piss you off? Figure out what really gets you going and get active. But for both this slide and the previous slide, figure out and try to narrow down your focus. We all want to save our world. We all care about animals. You got to figure out what you want to do or you'll just get overwhelmed. I can tell you, I get overwhelmed every day. One of the things you can do is what I'm calling community animal policing. Hopefully before you guys leave, I have a one-page sheet. It has all the, and I don't know how many of you will stay in Illinois, but it talks about all the different laws in Illinois. What this means is when you go home, when you're in your neighborhood, if you see somebody, a kid throwing a rock at a squirrel, go to that kid and say, stop it, that's not nice. If you see an older person abusing a dog, call 911. Take this stuff seriously. If you saw someone hurting a baby, if you saw someone, you know, punching someone else, you do it. Treat animals the exact same way. We now have a police unit in Chicago, 14 undercover agents. All they do is animal crime. So take this very seriously. We have some great laws in Illinois, and if wherever you end up, they'll be similar. Owner's duties, you got to basically take care of your dog, treatment, aggravated cruelty, animal torture. The one page I have describes all these in more detail. But, you know, think about getting involved. Take one of these sheets, and if you see anything, call me. If you don't want to call the police, if you have some more information, call me, and I'll take care of it. But make sure you report it, because that's how things get going. And I get so many tips every day from people who just see someone kicking their dog, someone who sees a, what was the other one? Last week, a zebra was being beaten with a stick at a circus over down the street. So our 2009 goals in Illinois. The biggest one is puppy mills and pet stores. We've got to get this under control. We have way too many dogs in the state of Illinois. In the city of Chicago alone, we euthanize 19,000 dogs and cats. We just have way too many animals coming in, and there's no reason we should be buying more, especially from these awful places. And we can talk about all these more in detail in just a few seconds. But then we also work on local legislation, which is where you can really get involved. I work with little tiny villages on chaining legislation or tethering, because it's hard to do at a state level because there's so many different municipalities. So say you live in Oak Park. You call me, I'll draft the law, you draft the law, I'll draft the press release, whatever you need, and we'll ban it, we'll limit it, whatever you think would be appropriate for that community. If you want to do more prohibitions on pet stores, we'll do that. Also, cage-free egg campaign. If you know anybody that owns a restaurant, ask them to buy cage-free eggs. That's a little bit of difference you can make every day. I'm going to talk really quickly about how to lobby, because that's kind of law I practice. I don't actually go into court, I lobby, which you might not think is like being a lawyer, but it really is almost identical. This is very similar to, if you just change the word government representative with judge, it's going to be very similar. You got to know who they are. You got to know who you're lobbying. You have to know, identify yourself. So when you go to a state rep, say who you are, say who you know. You go to a church, you belong to a group. If they know that you're going to go tell other people, they're more interested. How do you lobby? You just call them up. It's as simple as that. Don't be afraid. Make the phone call, send an email. The blast emails that you're going to get from HSUS are terrific. If you can take the extra effort, pick up the phone and actually reach someone, that's even better. And just, you know, make the phone call. It's so important. If you can get in and actually visit someone, even better, but make the phone call. How not to lobby. Don't threaten or antagonize a legislator. People won't agree with you all the time. I face it every day. I've had people not support bills because they were pro-life and my sponsor was pro-choice. Nothing to do with the merits of the bill. They're just being stupid about it. You just got to deal with that and say, well, I hope you reconsider, be as kind as you can. Don't refer just to bills by numbers. Don't say House Bill 2934. Nobody remembers that crap. Say puppy mill legislation. Say ban on carbon monoxide chambers. So be very focused. Listen to what they have to say. If they have questions, try and answer it. Don't lie to them. Say maybe you need to get back to them. Call me, call another group, get more information. And be very respectful. If you do talk to staff, just like when you guys are, anybody that's going to work for a judge or anything, staff is essential. The congressman, the representative, spend very little time looking at the legislation. It's the staff that does all the work. So be very polite. And if you get 5 minutes with the chief of staff, that's gold, because they will let the state rep know how to vote. So I'm not sure how well these photos are going to come out, but we'll try. Puppy mills. This is a Illinois licensed breeder. You can see at the bottom, they just let all the pee and crap collect on the floor. This is a breeder that's been licensed for about 10 years. All these dogs are standing on wire floors. Our legislation will change this. This is acceptable under current Illinois law. These dogs have never, these are all their breeding dogs. I think two over here on the second to the right had been in that cage for 9 years. It had never touched solid ground. When we took it out of the cage, we put it on the floor and it just dropped because it had never built up its muscle and its arms. These are not friendly places to be. This is another cage in the same facility, just stacked on top of each other. The smell, the noise is horrible. I don't know if you can see, but there's four little puppies just crammed in there as tight as they can, and that's how they spend their time. They're never, ever let out of the cage. That's how they live their life. This is just a three-hour difference. We took the dog to a local shelter called Paw Chicago, and this little puppy, I wish I had a video of it, just started playing with this pink towel and just started jumping and yapping. I think it was only 6 months old, the little dachshund. And it's amazing just taking him out of that facility. You could almost see him smile if dachshunds smile, but they don't. But he was really happy. So the other part of my job is I do puppy mill raids. I help with dog fighting raids. So if you hear about a bad puppy mill, you hear about a bad pet store, call me. This is a place in Arthur, Illinois, a non-licensed breeder, so a little bit worse. This is a situation where we ended up also having to work with the state, with the local county state's attorney who refused to prosecute. We put out so many phone calls, he had to disconnect his phone because it crashed his phone line. So, you know, we have different ways. We work nicely, we send nice letters, then the media, and then we crash their phone. But obviously this is just deplorable conditions. That's Chloe. One of the other good things, if you ever have a good bill or a piece of legislation or a court case, this is Chloe. So our puppy mill legislation is going to be called Chloe's Bill, because that puts a face on it, rather than talking about numbers. Some dogs, and just very unhappy there. This is a horse manure pile. You might ask why there's a picture of horse manure. That's where they put the dead puppies that didn't make it past 2 or 3 weeks. They would just bury them in the horse manure pile. It's not really relevant, but this was an Amish farm. We estimate between 60 and 80% of puppy mills are operated by the Amish for various reasons I'll talk to you about later if you're interested. This was a facility, just an outdoor barn, no heat, no air. For those of you who say, oh, I go to a good breeder, every dog here had AKC papers. So, give you a sense of what the AKC stands for. Now, does that mean there's no good breeders? No. When I was a kid, we got my mastiffs from a breeder. But we went to their house. We saw where they slept. So just because it says AKC doesn't mean anything. So, just a little bit about what we found from the Arthur case. We seized 55 dogs. There are two dead ones in the horse manure pile. We ended up getting about 12 more dogs out because some of them were pregnant and literally gave birth right after. They all had matted coats. There was a mother that gave birth to stillborn puppies. We thought she was going to give birth. She didn't. If we hadn't rushed her to the vet, she would have died because the puppies, this is the day after, were rotting inside of her, so she would have passed away. They all had paw injuries because they're standing on those wire floors. So not only does the wire go into their pads, but they're standing on their own urine and feces, so they get scalding on their pads. Just a horrible, horrible life. A lot of them had nails that were curling into their pad, so they had to remove them out of the pad. Just not a good place to be. Some of the puppies had gotten the slats look small, but if it's a two-week-old, I think they had some Shih Tzus and other things, you stick their hand in there, you can break your arm and stuff. And obviously, they didn't take any of these to the vets. one of the other bills that we're working on. This is an interesting story just because it gives you a sense of what you can do. Last year, I was working for that law firm. Someone told me that we allowed carbon monoxide euthanasia. So I was working at the law firm. It pissed me off. I wrote the bill. I went to a state rep, and I introduced it. It didn't get passed because we had some opposition. We're going to get it passed this year. But I did that while I was working at a law firm on my free time. So just because you're at a law firm, you can still get stuff done. It's a horrible process. They put up to 10, 15 dogs in one of those chambers, and then they have to run it for about 45 minutes. Usually the dogs in the middle don't end up dying, so they have to run it again. It's just a barbaric practice. As you all know, if you take your cat or dog, they use sodium pentobarbital, which takes seconds to put the dog to sleep. So hopefully we'll get that banned this year. Dog fighting as a spectator. Currently, it's a misdemeanor to be a spectator. So let me tell you what happens. The police and I go in. I usually don't go in because it's the SWAT team. They all have guns. And we're doing a raid, hopefully, this week. You've got 50 people there and two dogs. Don't think there's not lots of dogs there. They shipped in these two dogs that have been bred for that event. Well, you can only get a felony on people holding the dogs. Well, when the police come in, everyone drops the dog and run. So we've got to get the spectators because that's who has the money. That's who's continuing this kind of violent crime. There's a huge correlation, as you can see. 70% of people that were at dog fights have been arrested for other felonies, 70% for narcotics, 59% were gang members, and 49% have been arrested for battery related to a violent offense. So animal crimes and human crimes hand in hand. You'll see it all the time, and there's just tons of studies on it, so we gotta go after this. Currently, 21 states have a spectator felony provision, so hopefully we'll pass that this year. Allowing consumers the right not to buy a cat or dog fur. A lot of what you're gonna see in stores has trim. That trim does not need to be labeled under current law because there's an exemption under federal law. We're going to close that loophole. What they'll do is they'll say faux fur, or they just won't say anything. And what that really is, it's usually cat or dog fur from China. The dog, you can see here, they're all skinned alive. Usually the cat, they skin up by their neck and they rip the fur down. I'm sorry to be so graphic. You got to know why you care. Just saying, oh, fur, it's bad. No, this is a German Shepherd having its entire fur coat ripped off it while it's alive. So we need to get pissed off, we need to lobby for these, and we got to take action. The double-decker horse trailers. We've now banned the use or the slaughter of horse for meat consumption in the United States. What's happening now, though, is they're shipping all the horses to Mexico and Canada for slaughter. This trailer you see here is not for horses, it's for cows. So what happens is the horses are bending their necks for, you know, however many days it takes to get to Mexico or Canada. They're hurting their necks, they're rubbing their nose. In this case, the horses on the top floor, they don't have a good set level of gravity, so they're swaying back and forth, they fell over. What that means is they all, you know, they did a swerve to the side, all the horses fell over, it crashed. There were 59 horses there, 8 died on the scene, another 10 had to be euthanized because they're broken legs. This isn't just dangerous to the animals, it's dangerous to the people who then have to deal with these horses with broken legs. So hopefully we'll get rid of that this year. Electrocution of horses at rodeos. What they do is they take tame horses and buck them. Bucking horses is meant for wild animals. You're supposed to see if you can stay on. Well, these are sometimes tame animals. You can see the guy in the lower, he takes a zapper, zaps him inside the neck. Well, of course you're going to buck that. It's already a felony to use the electrical devices at a horse race. We're going to try and make it a felony to do it at a rodeo. This is always the quote I like to end with. The greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated. I always love a Gandhi quote. But, you know, let's remember that the way we're treating our cats and dogs, what we just did yesterday with Prop 2, allowing the animals to spread their wings and allowing them to move around and just be animals is just so important. I've got some cards over here if you want to contact me. I've got these one-pagers. There's my phone and email. For those of you that are interested and are going to be in Illinois, keep involved. The bills will get going in January, so if you can make some calls, this will make a difference. And if you have any questions, I guess we'll take questions afterwards. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
I'm Delcy Winders. I don't have a PowerPoint, so I'm hoping that this guy will go to sleep and not distract y'all too much. But I'm an associate attorney at Meyer, Glitzenstein & Crystal, which is a small public interest firm. I'm an animal law litigator, basically. And I'm going to talk about how I got to where I am, how I got to be in the fortunate position of practicing animal law full-time, which is exactly what I wanted to do, exactly why I went to law school, and about some of the cases that I work on, what it's like to practice at a public interest firm, and how that might differ from other settings where you practice animal law. I'm also next year going to be leaving the firm to work as the legal director of campaigns for Farm Sanctuary, so I'm particularly excited about Prop 2, which Jordan mentioned. It's going to affect about 20 million animals in California, so it's a huge deal. I went to law school specifically to practice animal law. I've been interested in animal issues, since I was about 14 years old and involved in constantly trying to figure out what I could do to make the lives of animals better and trying to figure out what was going on, how they were being exploited institutionally, and ultimately decided that based on my skills and abilities, being a lawyer would be the most effective thing that I could do. I started law school at a really lucky time. ALDF had been working for, they've been working for 30 years trying to get the field recognized, but for whatever reasons, the law schools were a little slow on the uptake and have only in relatively recent years been beginning to acknowledge animal law, although very quickly now. So I was lucky to just get in when it was already in the air. I decided to go to NYU because it was a strong public interest law school but didn't have a lot of, or really any animal law stuff going on. They did have a student animal legal defense fund, but it was very small and pretty inactive, and so I wanted to go there and do everything I could to help animals starting as a law student. So I did that, and I got the school to add an animal law class, started organizing events like this, and just want to acknowledge Vince and Aubrey for the work they've done, because I know it's really hard, and students are the people who get stuff going in animal law at law schools, and it's hard to get people to come out, it's hard to get the schools to do stuff, and it takes a lot of work, so I appreciate what they've done here. So I worked on getting the Student Animal Legal Defense Fund active, worked on getting a class added, which took 2 whole years, but did eventually happen. And since there wasn't a lot going on at law school, I joined the New York City Animal Law Committee. I know Pam mentioned animal law committees, and I know there's a committee in Chicago, and I definitely encourage you guys to get involved in that. It's probably the best thing I did in law school. I met amazing people who I'm still in touch with, who've been mentors to me. Including David Wolfson, who was supposed to be here, but he's too busy because he is doing a million things, including teaching the NYU course, teaching the course at Columbia, being a partner at a big firm. So he's been a great mentor to me, and he came on board to teach the class. So definitely get involved with committees. If you're interested in something besides animal law, I still recommend it. I think it's a great networking thing, and we all know networking is huge in the legal community. I also want to encourage you to write, as Pam did. You can also write pieces for journals. If you're on a generalist journal, I think that's great because you reach a wider audience. There's also a fantastic animal law journal out of Lewis and Clark Law School where you can try and publish pieces, or you can write things for the law school newspaper. The ABA Animal Law Committee also welcomes student-written pieces, so it's another avenue. There are also animal law moot courts. There's a national animal law moot court. There's a mock trial closing argument competition. There's also a legislative drafting competition. So there's tons and tons and tons of opportunities out there. It's a really amazing time for animal law right now. And do everything you can, but don't forget that you're in law school to learn the law also and take your study seriously, because I was clerking before I joined the firm, and there's definitely a lot of bad lawyering out there, and you're not going to help the animals a lot if you haven't focused on learning the law. So I'd say put that first and then do everything else you can on top of that. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about litigating. As I mentioned, I'm at Meyer, Glitzenstein & Crystal. It's a firm that was founded 15 years ago, and I do animal law exclusively. The firm, probably a third to a half of their practice at any time is animal law, and they've been doing that since the beginning. The other practice areas include environmental law, consumer protection, open government or Freedom of Information Act cases. And there's a lot of overlap between animal issues, obviously with things like the Endangered Species Act, but also with open government trying to get information about how people are treating animals behind closed doors and things like that. So I think the fact that the firm has been around for 15 years is a testament to the fact that you can indeed make a living practicing animal law. It's not a ton of money. It's certainly not what people at big firms are making, but it's enough to survive, and it's a very, very rewarding job. We're a pretty small firm. We have 7 attorneys and 3 support staff. And at any time, we have 2 to 3 law clerks, generally part-time during the semester, full-time during the summer. And we are hiring summer law clerks still, so if you're interested, definitely come up and talk with me about that. We provide services at below market rates, public interest rates, also on a statutory fee basis. A lot of statutes like the Endangered Species Act and other, the Freedom of Information Act case, Freedom of Information Act provide for you to be paid at market rates if you prevail in a case. So we rely on those statutes a lot. And so one of the cases that I've been working on is a case that's in defense of animals versus the United States Department of Agriculture. It's a Freedom of Information Act case. It's been going on for about 7 years, which indicates how long litigation goes on. It takes a long time, just like doing policy stuff. And this case, originally, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals did an undercover investigation of a company called Huntington Life Sciences about 10 years ago. Huntington Life Sciences, you may have heard of, is a contract research organization. So basically a company that gets hired by pharmaceutical companies, consumer product companies, makeup companies, what have you, to do their animal testing for them. They do testing on rodents, on beagles, on primates. And the PETA undercover investigator saw some really horrible stuff happening to animals, documented it, and then went to the USDA, filed a complaint, and the USDA is in charge of enforcing the Federal Animal Welfare Act, which protects research animals somewhat, did an investigation and brought a series of charges, I think it was 23 charges, I don't remember exactly off the top of my head, for violations of the Animal Welfare Act, which was virtually unprecedented. But within 2 weeks, they had entered into an agreement with Huntington Life Sciences where Huntington would not be found in violation of the Animal Welfare Act, would have to pay $10,000 to the federal government, which is nothing for this huge organization, and donate some money to an organization and improve their own caging. So our client in defense of animals wanted to find out, you know, what's going on, why is the USDA not enforcing the law, what was going on, but how are these animals being treated that prompted them to bring all these charges in the first place? They filed a Freedom of Information Act request, got a little bit of information, but didn't get what they really wanted, which is how are the animals being treated? And that's what is still at issue in this case. It's information about how animals were being treated 10 years ago. And the Huntington has intervened in the case. Huntington and USDA insist that it will cause Huntington substantial competitive injury if this information is disclosed, which is an exemption in the Freedom of Information Act. You don't have to disclose information if it's likely to cause substantial competitive injury. And we actually have to go to trial to litigate this, which hasn't happened in a Freedom of Information Act case, I don't think, since the 70s. It very, very rarely happens. So I'll be litigating that case in December. Another case that I'm working on is ASPCA versus Ringling Brothers, or Feld Entertainment. And that's probably our highest profile case. That case has been, it's in its 9th year now. So another long case, and that's an Endangered Species Act case focused on how Ringling Brothers treats its elephants, which are endangered Asian elephants. That's exclusively what it uses. The Endangered Species Act has a citizen suit provision, so citizens can bring suit, and we're representing a former barn man for Ringling named Tom Ryder, and then a coalition of animal groups, the ASPCA, the Animal Welfare Institute, the Fund for Animals, and the Animal Protection Institute. The Endangered Species Act prohibits harming any endangered species, and our allegations are that they routinely harm the elephants because they chain them for at least half of every day, and sometimes up to 60 to 70 hours straight. They chain them so they can't move around, basically. And these are animals who travel about 25 miles a day and only sleep 2 to 4 hours a day. And this results in them engaging in stereotypic behavior, where you see them swaying back and forth, bobbing their heads nonstop for hours on end sometimes. And our second allegation is that they harm the elephants by routinely beating them with bull hooks. And a bull hook is a fiberglass tool. It's about that long, and it has two hooks at the end, one that's straight and one that's curved. They're very sharp, and they're used to train and punish the elephants. And we have lots and lots of video footage of handlers and trainers hitting the elephants with them. They cause hook boils. Sometimes they cause the elephants to... we have one eyewitness testimony about the elephant dripping blood all over. So this is a huge case. It's really unfortunate. It's been going on for so long. The elephants have been enduring this treatment all this time. But we're supposed to be in trial right now, which is why I was originally not going to be here. But it's now been delayed to February 3rd. And it can be, it might be a groundbreaking case because the Endangered Species Act hasn't been used in this way to address how captive endangered animals are living. So those are a couple of the cases I've been working on. I'm working on a lot of other projects. I get to work with a bunch of different organizations. Some of the ones I've mentioned, also the ALDF and HSUS are clients of ours, Farm Sanctuary, International Fund for Animal Welfare, PETA, In Defense of Animals, and a bunch of other groups. So one of the things that I think is different about practicing in a small firm is that I get to see what all these different groups are doing instead of being very enmeshed in what one group is doing and what their campaigns are focused on. And the groups, although they may seem very similar and have very similar goals, are definitely have their disagreements and have ideological differences and definitely strategic differences. So it's really interesting to be on the outside observing all these different approaches. And sometimes when you have, you might have to build a coalition to put a case together. You might have two groups who want to go at the same issue in very different ways. You have to work with those issues, which I think is interesting. It's unfortunate because a lot of times you can't talk about all the different things you know, but we can talk about it amongst ourselves anyway. Another thing that I think is different, I don't have a lot of insight into working in a nonprofit. I will have more insight once I go over to Farm Sanctuary, but I did intern with Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine as a law student. And I noticed how litigation was really just a small part of a larger campaign that involved various departments of the organization. So it involved raising public awareness. There might have been a legislative aspect to the campaign. And you really saw how everything fit in together and we're talking with everybody in the organization. I don't get to see that as a litigator. I'm sort of a hired gun and I do, you know, this piece of it for the organization and don't always see how it fits into an overarching campaign. And then in terms of how working at a small firm differs from working at a big firm where you might do pro bono work, I can't speak from experience there. I have never worked at a big firm, so take what I say with a grain of salt. It's mostly based on conversations with friends, most of whom are at big firms. And the main difference, I think, is that you get to do substantive stuff much more quickly at a small public interest firm because they need you to. We don't have a lot of staff. So I have friends who've done exclusively doc review for a year or more sometimes. And we do have to do doc review because we don't have anybody else to push it off to, but we also do everything else. I was doing taking depositions within 4 months of being at the firm. I'm litigating this case in December. I've written I don't know how many briefs on my own. And that's very different from what I've heard from friends who are at large firms. And the one thing that sticks out in my head is a friend who was at a large firm that I won't name for 2 years. And he wasn't allowed to write an email to a client without having a senior partner read it over and heavily edit it. And I'm here, you know, taking depositions, organizing client meetings, being the main contact with opposing counsel. It's a very different experience. So I've enjoyed that. But that said, I think there are, you know, incredibly rewarding things to do at a larger firm. I think if you do pro bono work, that is an opportunity to start to get more experience because I do have friends who've done, on their pro bono cases, they've been afforded more flexibility in what they're doing. So I want to leave some time for questions. So I'll just, in closing, say I think it's really an exciting field to work in. It's a new field. It involves every aspect of the law. There's stuff constantly growing up. So I encourage you to get involved in it in any way. And it can be full-time, it can be doing something once a month, and there's just endless opportunities. So I'll end and let you guys ask questions.
Thank you. A lot of people probably have to go to class, but you can stick around for a couple minutes and people ask questions.
What's the rationale for having the slaughtering of horses? I'm just curious.
Sure. You know, the horse has an interesting, in many countries they eat horse. In the United States, we just find that that is part of our nation's heritage, and people don't like seeing it slaughtered. It's an animal that we chose. You know, the same reason that they eat dogs in other countries, it's just what we find acceptable and not acceptable. Right. Just in America, it's such a part of our culture and such a part of our history. That's why there's been this ban on horse slaughter. And no one really eats it in the United States. It's all slaughtered and shipped overseas. I'm sorry?
Why are they Amish?
Oh, they don't believe animals have souls. So they don't care how they treat animals.
Just a quick question for Elizabeth. I didn't hear any mention about specific legislation, and so I'm wondering if your organization has a stand on it.
I just got one. I was working with my dad's law firm, who works at a big law firm. We just got one overturned in a small city, and working right now. Illinois says you can't do it, but it's not well written. So we're actually introducing legislation this year to ban reproductive legislation in Illinois. There's about 18 communities in Illinois. There's also, interestingly, this is more of a federal issue, the Air Force and some military bases are now starting to ban certain breeds. One that pisses me off is it says no bully breeds, and I have an English bulldog. I don't know why you'd ban an English bulldog from an army base. That's interesting.
I don't know why you'd ban it from an army base.
Right. So, yeah, that's a huge initiative, and if you want to help us with that, that'd be terrific. Luckily, Animal Control and all the shelters agree with us because they're the ones that see these dogs. There's no difference. It's how they're treated. But certainly, our stance is that, you know, if a dog has been fought, if it's been trained to fight, there are times we recommend it be euthanized because it's more humane, because the dog's been so scarred that sometimes it can't be rehabbed. I know the Vic case is unusual, but you have to remember they got over $1 million, and none of those dogs had ever fought before. So that was an unusual case.
Yeah, only one dog is euthanized.
And we're involved. We don't have any campaigns, but to the extent that whenever we can draft and file amicus briefs or front of the court briefs to weigh on, that's where we find we're the most effective as a national organization. And we've just done that in Denver regarding the BSL there.
And I didn't even ask you, I'll throw in there that we're involved, for example, in Denver, we're advising the people who are bringing the challenge. We're advising the groups that are challenging the legislation in Denver, so we do get involved in that also.
I wonder if you could comment on what's happening with issues of standing for animals. I mean, so there's been a real problem of animals not having legal standing to challenge the non-enforcement of laws against abuse and neglect, and so there's been scholarly literature about that and advocating giving animals standing. In one case in D.C., held that a visitor to a zoo had standing to challenge the non-enforcement of these laws because his aesthetic experience was marred, but that seems a very bizarrely indirect way of getting enforcement. So what is the next on that issue?
I think about that case, ALDF versus Whitman. ALDF was involved in that, and our firm litigated that case. And unfortunately, the way the laws are written right now, that's the way you have to go. It's bizarre and very nonsensical. But the route that you've had to take is focused on human injury. There was a Supreme Court recently, not animal related at all, but had a pretty broad standing interpretation. And there was also a Ninth Circuit case that said someone was trying to use the Endangered Species Act to represent cetaceans, and the Ninth Circuit said this is not the way the statute's written. We don't think that the Constitution bars Congress from doing this if they do want to write a statute that does that. So I think there's definitely a door open constitutionally. Whether or not you have a legislature that will do that might be better today than it was yesterday. So I think it's a possibility, but there definitely needs to be work done on the legislative front. We relied on ALDF v. Glickman and the Ringling Brothers case, so we were able to have standing based on our, the court hasn't reviewed whether the organizations have standing, because you only need one plaintiff with standing, but our Tom Ryder, the handler, has standing because he worked very closely with seven of the elephants, and it's based on his emotional relationship with those elephants.
And I think our challenge is, you know, animal practitioners or animal law practitioners is to challenge the existing legal framework, but to figure out ways to work within the existing legal framework. So to go to the standing issue, we just had a case, our Mendez case, and the way we got into court is one of our plaintiffs, we alleged that the veal calves weren't being raised and treated within the state anti-cruelty laws. So we said that they were breaking the laws, and our plaintiffs purchased products, veal products and dairy. We had a host of claims, and they said they suffered injury because they thought they were being legally raised for food. And by breaking these anti-cruelty laws, they were not, and therefore they were injured. So it's all these different ways to try to get into court. We've done that twice. When the cork pork, they decided to shut down the industry, and then Mendez was dismissed. So you know, you win some and you lose some, but you keep trying.
Yeah. And there's definitely more opportunities in some states than federal courts. You don't have the Article III barrier. So.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, one issue that was specific to Chicago where standing came up was the foie gras ban, where around 30 to 40% of the restaurants that were serving foie gras before the ban continued to serve it because Mayor Daley came out publicly and said, this is my lowest priority as a chief executive officer of the city, and I do not care if the Department of Health enforces this law. And 40% openly served it. My guess is another 30 or 40% probably served it behind the scenes if you asked for it. And a year and a half later, the ban was repealed. But I guess my question is, given my experience with the foie gras ban and what we've seen with the Humane Slaughter Act, the Animal Welfare Act, and cases like HLS, how promising are legal strategies for change if we don't have standing, and even more importantly from my perspective, if we don't have the political institutions, the political will, and the popular support for more aggressive animal protection laws?
Well, I have to tell you, I think it's a good question. I was just on a call earlier, we were examining the Prop 2 results. It was not just urban votes that voted for this. This was the very ruralest of areas voted for this. So I think there is a movement. When you say, should a chicken be confined in a cage the size of a piece of paper, people get that. When you say a cow can't literally move an inch, they get that. So I think the popular movement is moving towards that, and we just kind of have to keep pushing. Just like the Greyhound thing, that took 4 or 5 years in Massachusetts. You got to just keep pounding and pounding. My carbon monoxide bill, I was pissed off last year that because the Veterinary Association didn't pass, I'm going to get it passed this year. So you just got to keep at it.
But I mean, you raise a really good point. You can have fantastic laws on the books, and if they're not enforced, it's pretty much worthless. And that's a problem with virtually all animal statutes right now, whether it's state anti-cruelty statutes, the Animal Welfare Act, everything. If it's not enforced, it's not particularly meaningful, which is why we're such a big fan of the Endangered Species Act, because it does have a citizen supervision. So I think that in making these efforts, we need to be focused, thinking ahead, how are we going to make sure this is enforced? If you can include some sort of citizen suit provision, and there are different ways of doing that. And it's also just, I mean, groups are starting to build relationships with prosecutors. I think that as the public becomes more aware, they're going to bring more pressure to bear on those responsible with enforcing the laws. As we have a different administration, hopefully there will be more concern with actually enforcing these laws. So it's, I mean, you definitely need to look at it.
And we do have a really cool group, if any of you want to get involved. It's called the Dog Action Work Advisors. They get a list of all court cases in Cook County, and if it's an animal cruelty case, they send someone to sit in the court to make sure the judge sentences the person properly. And the judges know these people because they're in the court a lot. And let me tell you, they have great success. The judges no longer say, you know, dismiss, no longer even give community service, they give fines, they give jail time. So you gotta let people know. If the people won't prosecute, I'll tell you what I do is, so I brought this puppy mill case to the prosecutor, really nice. Here's it all laid out. I'll draft the complaint for you. You won't do it. I'll have some people call you. I'll have the sheriff call you. You still won't do it, we go to the press. You know, and when the press get involved, they get calls, and then these people need to get reelected, especially in county state's attorneys and other elected officials. So get everyone involved.
Do you ever think that there's a tension, though, between the reformist strategies within the legal context that we work in today and mood strategies that are pushing public consciousness beyond the paradigm that we currently exist in. In other words, I mean, I think, you know, someone who's protesting HLS on the streets and demanding animal liberation, animal equality, believes, as Peter Singer wrote in 1974, that we exist in a society where there's a tyranny over non-humans, has a very different rhetorical approach than, say, HSUS does. And I wonder, I mean, how we navigate these tensions. And for someone who does endorse what Peter Singer endorsed in 1974, it's tricky for me to decide whether legal avenues are the best avenues for me to personally take as an activist, as opposed to working as a lawyer and just doing my activist things on the side, like volunteering for vegan outreach and passing out vegan leaflets.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a tension, and it's something, I mean, for me as a lawyer, that's something is constantly on my mind. I'm constantly trying to figure out how you pick which legal battles to choose, because there are all kinds of things you can choose, and you have to look at the long term, how this is contributing to the status of animals overall, and ALDF is fantastic at doing that, not just the short term effects. And I think it's just, being a lawyer is definitely a pragmatic position, and I think you just need to think about it.
And actually, Singer endorses that. Singer was here a couple of years ago when we started our Chicago project on animal treatment, where we were working out a consumer label to warn people of the conditions under which animals were raised for food. And, you know, some of the other activists were saying, well, why would you participate in this at all? Because it's about eating meat. But he said, no, you know, we have to stop the most egregious forms of cruelty first, and then we progress to the other issues.
And we try to do both at the same time, but it's a tough question, and it's one our movement constantly struggles with, constantly, and finger pointing, and this is wrong, and Prop 2, you know, everyone said, oh, it's fantastic, but you have other people say, no, you know, this gives people to feel okay about being humanely treated animals. And I think to answer your question, you know, you need to figure out for yourself what you think is the most effective, because our careers hopefully are very long, and I think that, you know, we're all going to try different things, and if we keep on fighting the fight, something's going to stick.
And I do have friends who are animal lawyers who are not comfortable with the concessions that organizations are making, so they're choosing to be criminal defense lawyers or civil rights lawyers and focusing on helping the people who are on the ground doing more radical stuff.
Right.
Because I do think those concessions are necessary, because, I mean, when we're working on the Fog Wild Man, one of the things that they told us, which I think is right, is you cannot mention vegetarianism at all. Just don't even say the word. Because the moment you say it, they're going to think, wow, I don't want to be thought of as someone who's condemning everyone for eating animals. I mean, this is a far wild issue, not a vegetarian issue. And like from my perspective personally, I complied with that, you know, that message discipline, but it left me with a lot of tension because, I mean, I was out in the streets leafleting pamphlets about factory farming, which I'm only every day almost. And like, it's hard for me to navigate those waters.
And it's a tough battle on other issues. For example, HSUS philosophically is opposed to hunting. But at the same time, we aren't trying to ban it anywhere, but we are trying to regulate it and say you can only do trapping in certain areas. You have to use humane traps. So it is tough, and then, you know, the NRA comes and yells at me and says, oh, they're against all hunting, they're just slippery slope. Well, you know, we do what we can. You do it what, you know, everyone needs to get elected, you have to realize that, and they can only vote for stuff that can get them reelected.
So do you admit that it is a slippery slope argument?
Oh, God, no.
No.
One bill at a time.
I also think this is something that other social movements have confronted, so you can learn from other, I mean, my boyfriend's a death penalty litigator, and they have this sort of, are you talking about this specific case or abolishing death penalty as a whole? It's coming from civil rights, so we can at least learn from other examples.
And, you know, one of the big things that I get is that in Illinois, as most states have a definition of companion animal, which is usually cats, dogs, and horses. They have a lot more protections than other animals. And, you know, that people get very upset when, you know, they call me about something and there's not much we can do about it because the law doesn't protect it in that way. So, you know, our society's also chosen certain animals that we almost find more valuable than others.
Yes, you know, I'm stressed out just thinking about it. But yes, I mean, I think, you know, and I'll stop because I know we don't have time, but education and advocacy cannot be undervalued either. I mean, it's wonderful that, you know, you're in law school and that we're all lawyers, but the more society becomes aware of the plight, I think they're not willing to allow it. You know, Vic was such a great example. I mean, the backlash from that and Hurricane Katrina and being able to leave with the evacuation plans and the pet food recall, I mean, those things really illuminate, I think, where we're striving to go with the legal system to match society's views. But it's frustrating and it's an uphill battle, but I think if we can do it through education and advocacy and legal work, we'll get there.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.